Forces on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, Friday and Saturday, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. The keynote speaker will be Sherry Hunkala, a national activist in anti-poverty movements and co-founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union and the Poor People's Economic Human Rights. This two-day conference will focus on areas of human rights, criminalization, and pathologizing of identities and experiences, revolutionary tools, and more. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fagrang, and the show is Fight the Empire. And we're going to start out. The main topic is about the Russia-China gas deal. But first, I'd like to say a little something about Senator from Georgia, Saxby Chambliss. Now, this controversy over Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, who was held prisoner by the Taliban for 5 years and has finally been freed. The uproar is getting uglier and uglier. People have been jumping in to pass judgment on this guy who has yet to defend himself. So, and among those jumping in on this deal was Senator from Georgia, Saxby Chambliss, who is retiring after this year, after 12 years in the Senate. Well, Saxby Chambliss was first elected to the Senate back in 2002. And his opponent at that time was a Democrat, Max Cleland. And Max Cleland had served in the Vietnam War. He had lost two legs and an arm, triple amputee. And part of Chambliss's campaign was an ad that showed Max Cleland sort of in there with Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. Chambliss, here's this guy who lost three limbs in a war, and Chambliss is accusing him, if not of being unpatriotic, Chambliss denies that. He said he's just accusing him of poor judgment. And it was a despicable campaign. It even had other Republicans outraged, and finally Chambliss' campaign had to pull that ad. So that tells you what kind of guy Saxby Chambliss is. And here he is jumping all over another U.S. soldier who is having hard times. And it's I find it kind of disgusting. So good riddance to Saxby Chambliss. I don't know. Hope that the people in Georgia elect somebody better. I don't know who is running to succeed him, but so much for Saxby Chambliss. I got nothing to say about Bo Bergdahl because I don't know the circumstances of his situation. And I suppose it'll all come out eventually. So let's get on to another topic. You know, we live in an era where for, you know, several centuries now, the West, meaning Europe and the United States, have pretty much run the world. And we're kind of used to it. Seems almost like the natural order of things. But it's when you think about it, this only began about 400 years ago, 500 years ago. Before that, for most of the world's history, Asia was the world's power center. There was one British sort of political theorist named Halford Mackinder who coined the Heartland Theory. And basically that Asia was seen as sort of the center of the world island. The world island includes Asia, Europe, and Africa. They're all sort of one continent in a way. And his theory was that whoever rules the world island or the world power center really kind of runs the world. And Europe was seen as an appendage, you know, it's a little peninsula sticking out of this great Eurasian continent. Well, what happened back in 1492, the European appendage set sail and they conquered what they called the New World, the Americas. And here was this vast, a double continent, North and South America, just full of, fresh land, resources, forests, and it's virtually untapped at the disposal of whoever conquered this vast continent. And so that's what Europe did. They conquered the New World. You know, the American dream basically includes killing Indians and taking their land. And to work on this bonanza, the conquerors tried enslaving the Indians, but that did not work. And so they began importing slaves from Africa to do the work. And this brought immense wealth to Europe. It jump-started capitalism. It gave birth to what we think of today as racism, which really didn't exist in the same form before that. And so Europe joined this bonanza, and then the American colonists, they declared independence, and they set about extending their rule from the 13 colonies along the Atlantic seaboard all the way across the continent to the West Coast, picking up one-third of Mexico on the way, and then extending the empire overseas. Well, when this began, this sort of global plunder, it was easy to think that it can go on forever, limitless resources. They are there. All you have to do is grab your share and work hard, and you too can become a millionaire. You too can get in on the action. Well, after a few hundred years of this, we find that the Euro Empire has used up these resources pretty much and lost control of these resources. Or to take one example, oil. When oil was first drilled in Pennsylvania back in 1859, they discovered oil. They hit the oil at 69 feet. And then that was followed by the gushers of Texas and Oklahoma. Well, now to get the oil, they have to drill miles under the ocean, horizontal drilling, and then they have to use this technique of fracking, which basically is scraping the bottom of the barrel. And so what's happened is that the West has kind of used up its share of these resources. And so right now, much of the world's oil and gas and other minerals are located within the Euro-Asian heartland. Mainly that means Russia and China, Kazakhstan and some of those other nations, Iran, include Iran in there, and Iraq. And so what's happening now is that the old world power center is coming back into power. Now, Zbigniew Brzezinski saw this. He wrote a book, The Grand Chessboard. To him, that's Eurasian continent was the grand chessboard. It was the prize. And he made one move in Afghanistan. To him, it was a neat idea where where the U.S. would supply the Mujahideen rebels against the Soviets. And his idea was, well, he sort of had a twofold idea. One, it was give the Soviets a taste of their own Vietnam. This happened in 1979 under President Jimmy Carter. And when we were still getting over our loss in Vietnam. And the other goal for Brzezinski was that it would cause the Soviet Union to get out of Eastern Europe. Brzezinski was born in Poland, and the Polish state of affairs was very much on his heart. And so the U.S. Was supplying all these Mujahideen rebels, these Islamic jihadis fighting the Soviets, including Osama bin Laden. And so they drove the Soviets out of Afghanistan, and but the whole thing backfired. Now we are leaving Afghanistan. We have lost another war. The whole idea of Brzezinski's an excellent idea kind of backfired. Another important part of the chessboard for Brzezinski was Ukraine. He called it a geopolitical pivot. And so we see what's going on in Ukraine the last year or so. We got to keep in mind that Ukraine is kind of a bogus nation state. For one thing, a nation and a nation state are not the same thing. A nation is when you have a group of people sharing a language and culture who are sort of living in proximity to each other, where they live as a nation. We talk about all sorts of different nations. A lot of them, the nation and the nation state are pretty much the same. The borders are where the nation is. But there are some nations that don't have a state. Well, Palestine is one. Kurdistan and the Kurds are a nation. They almost got one back after World War I, but then they lost out in the bargaining. And now they have a sort of state, but it's not official. It's just sort of de facto. Well, Ukraine is kind of like that. For most of Ukraine's history, the Ukrainian people, I mean, they've lived in pretty much the same area, but they've been ruled by different empires. They've been ruled by the Poles, by the Lithuanians, by the Ottoman Empire. And it was only recently that there even was such a thing as a Ukrainian nation state. It first came into being after the Russian Revolution, when the victorious Bolsheviks kind of created the Ukrainian Socialist Republic, and they gave it the sort of the borders it has today. Then later on, Premier Khrushchev threw in the Crimean Peninsula. But when you look at the nation state, it's really the bogus part is this, that part of what's called Ukraine today is the western part is populated by Ukrainian-speaking people who are generally Roman Catholics, and they share the Ukrainian culture. But the eastern part is inhabited by Russian speakers who belong to the Russian Orthodox Church. And then you have the Crimean Peninsula, which is even more so. And so when you have a nation like that, the borders are sort of out of whack with the people who live within them. And it's like one group of people gets to rule over the other. And so that's sort of the basis of the dispute going on in Ukraine. And the West jumped into it. It's a way of extending their encirclement of Russia, which shows you that the Cold War was not about containing communism. Russia is not communist now. It's a capitalist country, but still we are trying to contain it. And it all has to do with getting control of this Euro-Asian heartland. And so one reason the U.S. hates Vladimir Putin so much is that he, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Boris Yeltsin became the president, and he started giving away all sorts of concessions to the West. You know, we talk about oligarchs. The last count, I think, is about 100 oligarchs. And they gained their wealth mainly by grabbing public assets from the Soviet Union, sort of taking control of them and selling them off at bargain prices to the West and getting billions of dollars. So there are oligarchs in Russia. There are oligarchs in Ukraine. There are lots of oligarchs who have moved to Great Britain. London is sort of a paradise for these oligarchs who don't want to live under Putin. So there they are. I mean, they basically made their money by stealing from the people. And so when Putin took over, Boris Yeltsin, he was an alcoholic and he had to give up his post. And he selected Putin to succeed him. Well, Putin decided to put an end to this wholesale theft. And the U.S. has hated him ever since. Well, now the U.S., the new Ukrainian government is in charge. And they're fighting a civil war against the rebellious people of eastern Ukraine, and they want to be part of the European community. And the European community is already imposing European austerity on these people. And so the U.S., the West is kind of in a fix because they know that, I think the Ukrainian people realize that they've been had by the West. They think that they're going to join the European community and find prosperity, and that Ukrainian workers can travel west and get better jobs and all that. Well, it's not going to happen. So Putin has managed, he sort of fostered the secessionists in Crimea have taken over there. Oh, somebody tells me the Ukrainians are not Roman Catholic. Well, this is news to me. I thought they were, but in case I still think, well, I will leave that up to you. I don't know. Look it up. My impression was that the Ukrainians are Roman Catholics, or they have their national Catholic Church, but it's not the same as the Orthodox Church of Russia and Greece. But we'll just leave it at that. I mean, it's an interesting issue, and look it up. When the West took over Ukraine with its government is now in charge, and but Crimea has seceded. They have rejoined Russia. And eastern Ukraine is, who knows what the outcome will be there. There's a lot of fighting going on. It's developing into a civil war. So the West is punishing Russia, punishing Putin by imposing all sorts of sanctions. We're not going to buy their gas, as though that should be a telling blow. These austerity measures and the sanctions have pushed Russia into finally signing a $400 billion gas deal with China. In other words, Russia is telling the West, we don't need your business. We can sell all the gas we want to China, and in the process create a kind of a new economy all throughout Eurasia. This would include Russia and China and Kazakhstan and all these other Turkic nations there. It would eventually include maybe India and Iran. And so there's lots of resources there. There's lots of gas. There's lots of the remaining world's oil. And the one thing to keep in mind is that this oil can be transported around by pipeline rather than loaded onto tankers and sailed across oceans. So this $400 billion gas deal has immense consequences. Their plan is to boost investment in eastern Siberia and turn it into a gas hub for Japan and South Korea. And another important thing is that the payments trade in this within this this Eurasian Economic Union would be in Chinese and Russian currency. Meanwhile, the BRICS nations now include Russia and China, along with Brazil and India and South Africa, and they have they are planning to start their own development bank in July, as an alternative to the IMF and the World Bank. And so we see what's developing here, and the person who's been writing a lot about this, who we've had as a guest on this show a couple of times, is Pepe Escobar. We hope to have him this time, but he is in Russia right now writing about this. But you can look up Pepe Escobar. He writes for the Asia Times. He also writes for Russia Today, and he writes for the Tom Dispatch. So just do a web search, Pepe Escobar. That's Escobar. And he's written a lot on this, and he's travels around that area quite a lot. And he talks about sort of the new Silk Road. It would include the old Silk Road is basically this caravan trail from Europe into China, where traders went back and forth. Well, the new Silk Roads would include high-speed rail, which is already in existence, highways, pipelines, seaports, fiber optic networks, whole raft of communications and trade. And it would go all the way from China and Japan all the way to Germany. Apparently, the Chinese premier was in Germany recently, the end of this rail network, I think, would be Stuttgart, but who knows, it could go on to Portugal. So what's happening here is that the Europe, which is in pretty bad times right now, could once again become a kind of an appendage to this Eurasian kind of economy. What it shows is that America likes to think of itself as the indispensable nation. I think those are the words used by Madeleine Albright. Well, apparently Eurasia is in the process of dispensing with the United States, because they, Russia and China and these other nations, they have the world island. And what does the U.S. have? Well, we've used up all our own oil. We do have some, but it's being depleted. South America, which we once didn't rule directly, sort of indirectly, has been going its own way. And there is a contest now between these great powers for Africa. And so it's almost like the last 400 years of Euro-American empire are being reversed. And there's an interesting article. There's a web journal in British Columbia. It's called the Tyee, T-Y-E-E. And they have an interesting article by Andrew Nikiforuk, who is a Canadian writer. He's really written good stuff about the oil situation. And he is saying that the title of his recent article is "The Russia-China Gas Deal is a Train Wreck for British Columbia." And the reason being that British Columbia, you know, we talk about fracking and this has an impact here in the Pacific Northwest, too. For a long time, the prices of gas in Asia were much higher than in North America. Price of gas in North America went as low as $4 million, or $4 for a million BTU, where it's costing even more than that to extract. And so these gas companies have been pushing for selling this gas to mainly to China, because the prices there are so much higher. And it was The premier of British Columbia, Christy Clark, saw this as a bonanza. But now, with this Russia-China gas deal having taking effect, the whole hope for British Columbia and all these gas-exporting countries is evaporating. And we should look to this right now. There's a huge controversy here in the Pacific Northwest over these liquid natural gas terminals. There's one that's being talked about down in Coos Bay, and this is supposed to be the salvation of the economy down there. Well, it may not happen. This Russia-China gas deal may end all of that. It's been a kind of a pipe dream. And another thing to realize is that when you frack, fracking oil and fracking gas are not the same as drilling it right out of the ground. When you have to, like I said before, it's scraping the bottom of the barrel, which is expensive, and it does not get a sustained yield. What happens is that fracked oil and fracked gas, they deplete very rapidly. So all this talk about oil independence and all that and a big energy boom in this country, a lot of that is just, it's bogus. It's not going to happen. So the people who are opposing the liquid natural gas terminals in this country, they should, one argument against them, besides the environmental problems, which are immense, is that the Russia-China gas deal has kind of made that it's taken that off the table. There's not going to be a big boom selling natural gas at China because they can get it cheaper from Russia. And the reason they get it cheaper is because they can get it by pipeline, where here what you have to do is you have to pipe it to the terminals. Like, say, if they build one in Coos Bay, they'd have to freeze it down to practically absolute zero. They have to freeze it down very low, turning it into liquid, put it into a tanker, and then sail it across the Pacific to China, and then kind of unfreeze it and put it back in the pipeline. Well, that's much more expensive than just doing it in a pipeline from Russia. So this kind of deal is doomed from the start. And so my advice to Coos Bay is forget about the liquid natural gas terminal, because it's not going to happen. And the same applies to these projects that are being talked about all up and down the Pacific coast. I believe there's some up in Washington. There was one that was supposed to be, that was talked about in Astoria or somewhere along the Columbia River. So that is one of the effects of this Russia-China gas deal. So this is an immense thing that is happening where Russia and China seem to be coming together and forming this, a new economic powerhouse, which is leaving the United States and the West kind of out in the cold. Europe, they get their natural gas from Russia, and they will continue to get their gas from Russia, probably. But they're sort of torn between. They're not going to be getting it from the United States. And this, to find out more about this, I really recommend reading Pepe Escobar's articles. You can get them in the Asia Times. That's a good place to start. The Asia Times is a very good journal. There's lots of interesting articles there. Just look up Asia Times and you will see a lot of good stuff. So kind of a taste of things to come. We're looking a little further ahead than most of our elected leaders and business leaders do these days. And so stay tuned. Stay tuned to KBOO. What's coming up next, I believe, is Flashpoints. So stay tuned.
Yes, indeed. Flashpoints is next on KBOO Portland. The Mighty Boo on your Thursday morning. In about 1 hour, join us for Between the Covers, where today host Jim Schumach speaks with Phil Klei about his novel Redeployment, which takes readers to the front lines of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And then at 11:30, Black Book Talk remembers the great Maya Angelou, who died last week. As mentioned, Air Cascadia is off today, and we will be heading right into Flashpoints momentarily, today featuring a report from Mexico City on a series of people's caravans calling for the protection of Central Americans migrating through Mexico to the U.S. Also, it's been 1 year since Edward Snowden's first massive release of secret NSA documents. They'll speak to Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, about the multiple impacts of Snowden's actions. That is all coming up next on KBOO. Thanks for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, with a keynote speaker on June 6th, an all-day conference June 7th at Portland State University. Voices on the Ground is hosted by the Social Welfare Action Alliance and the School of Social Work at PSU, with the goal of providing space for the larger community of activists and organizations to connect and engage students and the broader community in an effort to build meaningful, collaborative relationships. Again, that's Voices on the Ground, Resistance and Resilience, June 6th and 7th at Portland State University. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Flashpoints, we feature an exclusive report from Mexico City on a series of people's caravans calling for the protection of Central Americans migrating through Mexico to the U.S. Also, it's been 1 year since Edward